And when people talk about homelessness, yeah, we've got to do something about it. But it is not as simple as many people think it is.
That we all need to own this collectively and rebuild the sense of a common good.
And now the private sector realizes it's a calling. It's a calling to everyone involved in the private sector to realize that we need to give back.
Hi, welcome to GeekWire. I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook. My colleague Todd Bishop is off this week. We're coming to you from GeekWire in Seattle, where we report each day on what's happening around us in technology, science, and innovation. What happens here matters everywhere, and every week on this show, we talk about some of the biggest and most interesting stories we've been covering. For this week's show, we're going to listen to the first session in our new Civic Conversations virtual event series, which is presented by Microsoft. The session was recorded Thursday afternoon and moderated by GeekWire contributing editor, Monica Nicholsberg. Let's listen in.
This is the first in three virtual events we'll be doing this year in partnership with Microsoft, the underwriting sponsor of GeekWire's Civic coverage, where we'll explore the intersection of public policy and technology. To see all of our coverage in this area, just go to geekwire.com/civic. We've got a timely discussion in store for today, coming 1 year after the shutdown of Washington State's economy, as hopeful signs emerge for how we can bounce back. It's going to take every ounce of our community's strength to regroup from the past 12 months, and we hope this event will shed some light on the challenges and solutions ahead. We'll introduce our featured speakers in just a few moments, but first we want to thank our partner on today's event, Microsoft, and it's my pleasure to welcome Jane Broom, Senior Director of Microsoft Philanthropies, to say a few words.
Thank you, Monica, and thank you to GeekWire and to all the avid GeekWire fans out there. We are delighted to be here. Greetings from my guest room here on Capitol Hill in Seattle, hopefully for not much longer. Hey, this conversation is so important and it's so timely. This has been an incredible year for our community. And for me personally, as somebody who's been working in, actually, I'll say this, as a lifelong Washingtonian, I have to say I could not be more proud of the way our community has come together in the last year. Those are the businesses, the government, policymakers, and just everybody we're seeing in the community, everybody pitching in and doing all they can to help support our neighbors as we go through this process. I am seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, and I am so excited. I think all of you are seeing the light at the end of the tunnel, but we still have a lot of work to do. And I think one of the things that has been most important in the last year is the notion that we must come together and rebuild, but do so in an inclusive and an equitable way so that communities are really at the center of what we do. And that's why I'm so excited about the conversation today. The United Way, the Seattle Foundation, Challenge Seattle, these leaders who have just been on the forefront of these efforts, but have been doing so in a way that centers community the whole time. So thank you for this opportunity. Microsoft has been here for this time, and we're committed to stay with you all for the long term to make sure that this community continues to be a thriving economy and a place that just has the highest quality of life for everybody that lives and works here. So thank you. Take it away.
Thank you, Jane, for joining us. And thanks, Microsoft, for your support of GeekWire Civic coverage. Now let's meet our panel. Joining us, we have Christine Gregoire, CEO of Challenge Seattle and the former governor of Washington State. Gordon McHenry Jr., President and CEO of the United Way of King County, and Chris Hermans, Chief Impact Officer at the Seattle Foundation. Welcome, Christine, Gordon, and Chris. I am so glad that you're joining us today because we're really living in this very historic moment. And I do see the light of the light at the end of the tunnel, as Jane said, but at the same time, we're dealing with these parallel challenges that include the pandemic, systemic racism, an economic downturn, and a climate crisis. So I want to ask our panelists, when you look at the year ahead in our region, what should be the government's top priority? Governor Gregoire, do you want to kick us off?
Sure. Thank you. Thanks to GeekWire. Thanks to Microsoft for the sponsorship and to my colleagues, Chris and Gordon, great to be with you, and to everybody who's joined today. You know, as I look out, we went into COVID with some issues, and COVID has really made those issues even bigger and in some instances much worse. So I think the challenge for the public sector is to really come out of this, having addressed the problems that existed pre-COVID in a way that will make us much more able to thrive going forward and much more equitable. So I would put at the top, how do we make sure that we develop economically in a way that is inclusionary? Big businesses, many of them have managed to be successful during the course of COVID. Small businesses have suffered dramatically. Minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses have suffered dramatically. Women have suffered in the workplace. So we need to focus and really pay attention there. And I think that's a task for the public sector. Secondly, I think we need to look at racial equity. We cannot afford any longer to have the disparities that we saw before COVID that were exacerbated by COVID. So again, when we come out, let's come out better than we were before COVID, and let's come out sustainably so that we don't see these problems continuing to move forward. And then I also think, of course, we need to look at fundamentals, the infrastructure, transportation, and the other associated issues, affordable housing. Yes, obviously for our homeless, but also for our low-income, middle-income people who are being driven out, literally, of our large cities like Seattle. And homelessness has to be absolutely considered an urgent issue that needs immediate attention. We can't thrive economically. We can't have our communities come together, and we can't save lives unless we're willing to step up, particularly with regard to our chronic homeless.
Professor Gordon, do you agree that equitable recovery should be public policy priority number one right now?
Yeah, Gordon here. Yes, I do agree that is a very high priority. I think everything that the governor said is spot on. I would remind folks that early in the crisis, we came up with a new descriptor, essential services. And so it spans a wide range. It was appropriate because in such a quick moment in time, we lost all the key elements of social cohesion, libraries, community centers, challenge on healthcare providers. And so I think when I think about what the governor said, I agree. And I also, we've been so focused on housing stability. And so we talk a lot about homelessness in our community, and we need and we must talk about it. I think about the 10,000 households that we've worked with to provide rental assistance. That's like 30,000 individuals. There's 5,000 on a waiting list that is just a couple weeks old. So what if those folks didn't get rental assistance? So how do we lock in, to the governor's point, how do we lock in some of the innovation and protection and of essential services as we come out of this crisis so that we do have a stronger, a more inclusive, equitable, and supported community? So those are the challenges. And Jane Broom hit it on the head. We all came together, public, private, nonprofit partnerships, philanthropy, and that's great. And that's what was needed. How do we do it on a sustainable long-term basis?
Chris, I know it's been about a year since the Seattle Foundation launched its COVID-19 response fund. You raised, I think, $30 million for grants to community organizations. Can you catch us up on where that initiative stands and what you've learned from it over the past year?
Absolutely. And I would just concur with what both Governor Gregoire and Gordon have surfaced. I think that the compounding crises of the past year just kind of pulled the curtain back on how broken our systems are and our society is. I think the priorities really, I think, are not necessarily issue specific. It's around principles. And I think both the governor and Gordon lifted it up in terms of that everything has to be considered through a racial and economic equity frame and lens. We have to make sure that, I think one of the key things we've learned is not just how interconnected we all are, but how interdependent we are. And so as both Governor Gregoire and Gordon lifted up, the importance of creating a safety net to ensure working families and low-wage workers have a baseline of stability and economic security is critical. And I think we just recognized with the COVID-19 Response Fund, and while Seattle Foundation hosted it, it really was, as both Jane and Gordon have emphasized, a unprecedented cross-system, cross-sector effort. It was really working together in ways we hadn't before. And I think as another priority, it's the only way forward, especially if we are going to tackle not just the racialized disparities, but how they show up and impact our community across the region and housing and homelessness, economic security, childcare and healthcare, especially mental behavioral health services, and education equity and climate change. So what we really saw for the COVID-19 Response Fund was just how deeply vulnerable our residents, workers, and families are. And I think that we recognized that it was important more than anything to work alongside of the private sector and the public sector to show where philanthropy could have unique value add in supporting residents who may not have been able to access, due multitude of barriers, those basic supports to ensure that they could keep a roof over their head, food at their table, their children safe, and their heat and electricity on. And it was just an extraordinary effort that we've all put in place to be able to do this. And I think we also saw the way that the public sector, the government at all levels, were able to pivot and shift policy in order to be able to respond in this acute crisis. And I think we all know that we have to bring that same public and political will for the long-term rebuilding. And so while we look back to learn, we can't go back, and we cannot keep doing what we've been doing. And I think that's one of the key lessons, you know, that really focusing on racial and economic equity, supporting the most vulnerable workers and families, knowing that everyone was going to be impacted by the crisis and the compounding crises, but we would be impacted differently. And Black and Indigenous families of color were disproportionately impacted. And so I think for the work going forward, this collective effort, we have pivoted after the $30 million has been awarded to trusted community partners across the region. We're focusing on this going from relief to recovery to a reimagined and reinvented future. And so we've launched the Fund for Inclusive Recovery specifically to start working on that long-term vision for a more inclusive and equitable recovery.
When we talk about equitable recovery, you know, there's this big debate happening in our state right now over who should pay for recovery and how we balance the needs of different communities. Gordon, as you were mentioning, you know, you work with some of the most vulnerable people in our state. How do you think we should thread the line and balance their needs with the very real needs of businesses and our employers who also are struggling to recover?
Mm-hmm. Sure. And I think the two are very much related because there are, you know, too large a number of people in the state and in our county and our Puget Sound region who are challenged in terms of living, you know, below a federal poverty line, being housing burdened. The governor talked about low income and medium or moderate income. Those folks are struggling right now. And when they struggle, they are not producing they're not demanding the services or providing, you know, buying goods and services that that businesses need to be profitable. And instead, it's a challenge on the nonprofit sector and on the public sector in terms of those essential services. So I see it being very much related. And so we need to be focused on that. And I think we have to look at it from a sense of support and empowerment, not a deficit. We're very active with the community college, the two-year college system. the vast majority of the folks who are in that are looking to improve themselves by getting a two-year degree or vocational certification so they can land and have a living wage, a family wage. When you peel back the numbers, those are a lot of single parents. Those are a lot of folks who are first to go to college. Those are a lot of members from our BIPOC community. And they are in the academic setting and, you know, trying to manage family and manage through a crisis. And so they're looking for support, not looking, you know, for, you know, a favor or for charity. And I think too often we have to humanize our systems and our way of thinking so that it is inclusive of everybody. But also recognize, I think, to Chris's point, that for way too long, and not because of individual fault, but because of systems that disadvantage people of color and women and those who have a different approach in terms of their identities, their core identities, they have greater burdens. And so we have a societal burden, societal obligation, excuse me, to try to rectify that. And so I think we invest in those services, and we put energy around changing the systems that have perpetuated the harm. And then when we do that, and I think I'll just stop in just a second. I would say that one thing this last year has shown all of us, philanthropy and in the private sector, and the governor's, I know, going to speak to it, people are aware. And so I think we've gone from we've gone from sympathy to empathy to solidarity. And now we have people who want to be in terms of action. They're action oriented. And so Challenge Seattle is very active in that area. They've got an economic recovery plan. We're talking to them. We're in partnership with a bunch of BIPOC communities, organizations, and leaders who want to partner with the private sector to really drive this inclusive economic recovery that the governor and Chris have spoken about. So I think we're well positioned if we can do it in a courageous and authentic relationship approach.
Let's take a break from our Civic Conversations event. After we come back, GeekWire contributing editor Monica Nicholsberg will talk with our panelists about what Seattle needs to do to ensure a post-pandemic recovery for the city's urban core.
Technology moves fast. I need to move faster. WGU's competency-based education puts me in control of how fast I move through my IT degree program. I can accelerate my program by applying what I already know to my courses and focusing on the things I need to learn. Earn a respected accredited degree that propels your career in the IT field. Learn more at wgu.edu/IT Certs Included.
Welcome back to the GeekWire podcast. This week, we're listening to the first of our new Civic Conversations event series.
There is a bit of a wild card here, another force that's underway that we don't entirely know how is going to play out. But it seems pretty clear that remote work in some shape or form is going to last longer than the pandemic. And when we think about the economic center of our region, the urban core, how do we ensure recovery there, if the reality is just that the number of commuters who used to go to and from that area are no longer going to return? Governor Gregoire, I think you had some thoughts on this.
So I think it's premature for us to forecast what's going to happen. We have a younger generation that, in particular, because we've done a lot of polling about it, that want to be in a vibrant city. They want to partake of the collegiality that they can find in their workspace. They want to be a part of restaurants that are and outdoors and arts, music, so on. So I think the idea that while we've worked from home is our longstanding future, I'm not convinced that that's all true. To some, that will be a option, and I think they will avail themselves of it. But I think there's going to be people who want to gravitate back. And I sure hope so, because in order for a city like Seattle or Bellevue or many others to be vibrant, they need a downtown population. They need those restaurants up and working and running again. They need those small businesses being visited on a daily basis. So when I've talked to some of the experts, they've actually cautioned forecasting on this, because what they've said is you need to remember, we do have a relatively short memory in this country. And so while COVID is front and center in all of our minds right now, it won't be in 3 years or 2 years or what have you. And there will be this willingness to go back. But when we do it, we've got to do it right. And we've learned some lessons pre-COVID and during COVID that we can absolutely take into consideration as people return to work, how we can do it in a way that is far better than what we were doing pre-COVID.
What are some of the employers that you work with through Challenge Seattle saying that they need in order to make the return to work happen?
Well, there's a lot of concern. One about schools and getting our students back into the schools. Now, it's not, some might say, well, that's a daycare or childcare issue. Yes, that's part of it, because our workers do need to be able to free themselves up to go to work. And and COVID has taken unduly burden on women because of that. But it's also because that's our workforce of tomorrow. And the learning loss that's there is dramatic. Some of our children have lost a year in math, a year in reading. That's not easy to make up. We did some real hardcore work for the governor about what do we need to do to mitigate learning loss. And I will share with all of you, it is no easy task. It's going to take a significant investment, long hours. And think about the loss that's also come beyond academics, the lack of socialization, the mental health issues, and so on. We got a lot of work to do there. Secondly, homelessness comes up all the time. There are too many employers whose employees are afraid to come back to work downtown because their bus stop is not safe. So I think there are bigger issues than that alone with regard to homelessness, but it is an absolute crisis. And we can't afford to wait another day. Human lives are being lost. Our economy is being held back. Our communities are not feeling safe and secure. So we need to get the right help that is going to be able to allow us to pattern what has happened in places like San Diego, where they have been very successful at taking care of that chronic homeless population by getting them the on-demand services they need and deserve, housing that they absolutely desperately have to have, and an opportunity to get back their lives and to actually begin the process of getting to work and being productive members of the community. So when I hear from my CEOs, those are the two things that they say in order to get people back to work are absolutely important.
It's very consistent with what we saw from readers who we polled before this event. We asked them to send us their questions, and there are a lot of folks in our community who are asking about and wondering about the same things. So I wonder if you have any thoughts on what the tech industry or business community more broadly can do to address this homelessness crisis that we've been in for many years, because it is such a high priority for them.
Can I jump in just because I want to amplify, I think, what the governor was speaking to. You use the phrase chronic homelessness, and I don't know if people fully appreciate, you know, what that is. That's a defined term in many aspects. In one aspect, it's defined as a person who has been homeless for 2 years or has had several bouts of homelessness within 2 years and who has an underlying challenge, like a disability. And I think what people actually see and what they fear is not necessarily just the state of homelessness. It's the fact that the people that they are seeing and concerned about, they're under incredible stress and duress because they've been living outside. So I think all of you who are listening and you're in the comfort of your homes right now, I suspect, just imagine your stress levels, your mental status, if you've been living outside for 2 years in Greater Seattle, or if you've been in and out of the homeless situation several times in the past 2 years. Do you have some mental health challenges? Do you have behavioral health? Are you challenged because of alcohol or drug addictions? Are you escaping domestic violence? Have you been in and out of domestic violence? This is the aspect of home that's all under the rubric of homelessness. So I think I liken it to what I learned about icebreakers, you know, after the Titanic movie. There's a lot more mass under the water than there is above the waterline. And when people talk about homelessness, yeah, we've got to do something about it. But it is not as simple as many people think it is to just move people, you know, from their tent into a shelter, because they have all these other issues that got them there in the first place. So what is a shorthand? What do businesses and community and nonprofit and public sector need to do? We need mental and behavioral health treatment on demand or when needed. We need to have mental crisis intervention happen, not from a police officer, but from somebody who's trained in de-escalation, trained in mental and behavioral issues. That's not where we've gotten to yet. And so we haven't gotten beyond encampments and tents and aberrant behavior to dealing with the fact that folks are not choosing to be homeless. They are struggling to live, and they have these really core issues. And we as a community, as a society, have not recognized that or dealt with it.
Yeah, and I would just add on to both what Governor Greg Warren and Gordon have raised. And Monica, I think it ties through a number of your earlier questions. I don't think anything of what we're talking about is the government alone or business alone or technology. It really is fundamentally that we all need to own this collectively and rebuild the sense of a common good. And recognizing that when our most vulnerable residents and workers and families are stabilized, all of us do better. And I think what we have seen, and you know, Governor Gregoire's kind of reporting of some of the polling really shows, is that there is, you know, on the surface, a real interest and commitment in solving these. And actually, when you start looking at what it's actually going to take in particular to address root causes, oftentimes there's actually not the political and public will to do the hard things. And that's actually, I think, more than anything, where we need to come together in terms of policy priorities to say that we saw the way that businesses, elected leaders, government officials made hard decisions this past year around some key policy issues. It's that same kind of courage that we need to bring forward when addressing some of these essential needs that are really, if not addressed, will continue to threaten the vibrancy of this region. And I think Gordon very well pointed out, and Governor Gregoire touched on, you know, there is important legislation in the state legislature right now around extending and expanding behavioral health supports, especially more permanent supports, and you know, working to ensure that people have access to more durable care and supports over the long term. Similarly, we know that there's important legislation and policies being considered both at the county, city, as well as state and federal level around housing, affordable housing production, around support of rental assistance, around just cause evictions, and around really fully funding the housing trust fund. All of that is just core to what we're talking about. And I think we also just see, you know, again, to what Governor Gregoire raised, is, you know, this piece around educational equity and access. And we know that especially for families who have children with independent education plans and children with disabilities, that learning loss is even more significant. And thinking about, again, what's our targeted approach in supporting families like that? And then as well around childcare, very important legislation with Fair Start, F-A-I-R Start, around really supporting working families. Because we know, as Governor Gregoire pointed out, that the economic devastation has had an impact more so on working women, and especially on single working moms and women of color. And I think we what we have to be careful of, I think, not to show that it's either individual workers and families pitting against small businesses. In fact, if you look at family care homes, which are licensed child care providers in homes across the state. A very large proportion are immigrant women, women of color, who are running these businesses. And the combination of being able to ensure we're supporting the small business, providing care for working families, they're intertwined. And that's, the same kind of approach we need to take take to all of the critical issues that really will be core to our reimagining and reinventing our systems for a more equitable future.
I think what you just said is really interesting in regards to the way that the public and private sector really came together to immediately address some of the pressing needs during the COVID crisis. You know, I'm thinking back to the very beginning when businesses worked together to ensure enough PPE for our healthcare workers, all the way to today, when I know Challenge Seattle is really involved with standing up, facilities to streamline vaccine distribution. And it makes me kind of wonder why we haven't had the same sort of crisis response to the crisis of homelessness that we've been in for several years now.
So I think this has been a learning lesson for everyone. And the learning is that we can't just leave the issues of today to one sector. The nonprofit cannot. The public alone cannot. And the private alone cannot. But if we all work together, it is amazing what we can accomplish. So the public-private partnership that we started literally on March 2nd, 2020, was unprecedented and got national attention, and deservedly so. And it was, yes, all those sectors, and in the community chipping in, every one of them trying to be a part of the solution, not part of the problem. So what I think has happened, and what we've got going now, where we've stood up this command center at the Department of Health, where the Department of Health's in charge, but supported by the private sector, that's unprecedented around the country. And out of it are coming amazing ideas. So when we first had our conversation with the governor and we said, we don't pretend to understand all the issues that the Department of Health has to do, but Starbucks does deliver 100 million cups of coffee worldwide every week to satisfied customers. Do you think we could help on the logistics so that we can get shots in arms for the people of the great state of Washington? And the governor stood up the command center and off we've gone, and with tremendous success. So I think it has opened up a door for us, opened up an amazing door, where now I think the private sector, the nonprofit's always been there, quite frankly. Public sector has struggled trying to do things alone. And now the private sector realizes it's a calling. It's a calling to everyone involved in the private sector to realize that we need to give back. We need to contribute. We need to be a part of the solution. So when it comes to things like homelessness, that we must play a role as well. And we must understand the Lived Experience Coalition. They have get insights that I could never have because I've never experienced it. We have to listen to the BIPOC community. They have lived experience I have never had. They have ideas, solutions, wonderful, new, energetic ways to address some of our most pressing problems. So if we listen to each other, and we learn from each other, we put our expertise and our resources together, I don't think there's anything we can't accomplish. I've been really clear with my 21 members. Helping the community is no longer writing a check. Yes, writing a check is good and must continue, but we need a whole lot more. We need personal engagement, personal involvement, expertise, loaning people, really working together with the public and the nonprofit sectors. And if we do, I think the future is really, really good for all of us.
We're talking about the broader responsibility of our companies, essentially, here. And I've been wondering about what role they can or should play in encouraging vaccine rates to increase. So, you know, Microsoft just had this big announcement that they're going to start returning their employees to their offices. And I'm curious if you think it should be incumbent on these big employers to require some level of vaccination in order to return to work?
Well, we've talked a lot about that. And by far and away, most of my members have said they will not require but they will absolutely encourage, and they are clearly doing that. So we have a noon briefing that we began on March 2nd. We expected it to last a couple of weeks, and sarcastically yesterday I said it did last a couple of weeks, in a year that we've been doing this. But what we've done is we've put before the employers the science, the facts, the data, the experts, and they in turn are communicating that out to their own employees. We're blessed. We're blessed. We've got the University of Washington. We've got Fred Hutch. We've got the Gates Foundation. We've got resources here that nobody else has that can communicate the truth about what is the truth about the vaccines and the transmissibility and so on. And we're at the forefront of advising the White House on all of these issues. So we're trying to communicate and let people make informed decisions, but also let people understand that an informed decision is a decision for yourself, your family, and your community. I've had both my vaccines. I still double mask because while I may not get sick, I could possibly transmit it to someone else and not know that I had it. It's my duty as a Washingtonian to protect my colleagues in my community and across the state. So we are absolutely trying to get all of those issues before all of the employees and their families to say we all have a responsibility. We all have to stand up to it. And we will give you all of the absolute factual information for you to make an informed decision about your vaccination.
Let's take another break. When we come back, GeekWire's Monica Nicholsburg and our panelists discuss how the experiences of Black, Indigenous, and people of color in Seattle need to be central to reimagining our city and our society.
This GeekWire podcast is sponsored in part by Yale University Press. Are you concerned about the rise of AI and how it will impact our society? Every day, artificial intelligence presents us with urgent ethical challenges. How do we harness this extraordinary technology to empower rather than oppress? Nigel Shadbolt and Roger Hampson have written a how-to for building ethical machine intelligence. Their new book, As If Human, Ethics in Artificial Intelligence, is now available wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to the GeekWire podcast. We're listening to the first of our new Civic Conversations event series with contributing editor Monica Nicholsburg as our moderator.
Despite the fact that there are real challenges to achieving herd immunity through widespread vaccination, in some ways, it's a little bit of an easier challenge to get our minds around because there is a solution, a very clear solution. I'm thinking about the more difficult problem of systemic racism. You know, we've been talking about the twin pandemics, the pandemic of racism that we are confronting. And we can't forget the racial justice protests over the past summer that really rocked our community. I wonder if any of you have thoughts on what long-term impact that movement will have and where it stands now. And Gordon, maybe you can jump in.
I really appreciate Chris Herman's here saying, you know, relief, recovery, reimagine. And I think that is the reimagining is an aspect of the desire for racial justice and to address racial inequity. The challenge is that, and the governor used the expression lived experience, and that's spot on. You know, it's the folks who fall under the descriptor BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, people of color. It's their lived experience, their living experience that needs to be core and central to how we reimagine all the elements of our society. And I think that starts with seeing them, first of all. And maybe that's why there is even an expression called Black Lives Matter. You know, do you see that person and do you recognize them as a human being? And does their humanity matter to you? Once you get to that point, is then, well, let me be in relationship with the folks who have been marginalized and oppressed, and let me hear from them how they reimagine things like community safety. And so I think that is the challenge for us as a society. For the folks who have the living experience and for their ancestors who had the lived experience, how do you expect them to have faith and trust in the powers, whether it's public sector or businesses, even philanthropy with a charity model? How do you expect them to trust that things will be different this next year when we're talking about behavior, structures, systems, and culture that goes back hundreds of years. And that's the challenge. I think there is a willingness, that is the hope, and that is also the fuel that fuels the anger, the frustration, the fear that results in protest, that resulted in the protest of last year and the protests that are still occurring and will continue to occur until the people who have not been seen, who have not been appreciated, who have not been a part of designing systems and making key decisions are brought into that process in a way that they feel is respectful and safe and likely to result in the change.
And I think that building off of Gordon's point, I think, again, there is an example of how we did differently this past year, specifically around like the COVID-19 Response Fund, Gordon's work, many efforts focused on ensuring we prioritized making grants and investments in BIPOC-led and rooted culturally and linguistically specific organizations that are trusted in communities most impacted, who have a long history of reasonable distrust. And so I think as we're thinking through, and Gordon really touched on this in terms of really strong examples about living experience, the reality is we have created systems and have gotten the outcomes that they were designed to get. And oftentimes those systems weren't actually tested and adapted based on the experience of people who actually utilize them. And I think what we're starting to recognize is the importance of balancing the need to have science drive us, but also data, including community knowledge and community lived experience about how they interact with and how those systems actually prevent them from equitable opportunities and outcomes. And so, like with the COVID-19 Response Fund, I think ended up over 70% of the grants went to Black, Indigenous, and people of color led and rooted groups. The bridge that we're building towards the Fund for Inclusive Recovery is specifically around continuing to build and strengthen the infrastructure and capacity of BIPOC-led organizations and movements and coalitions, as well as further extend and support marginalized families and workers and residents being engaged in civic and public life. But I think that's the piece that we really have to recognize, is that making that kind of targeted investment is actually a benefit to all of us. And that is, I think, again, back to your question, Monica, about what business can do around the vaccine access. There is a vaccine equity dimension to all of this. And we know that continuing to lift up the ways that Black and Indigenous and communities of color are specifically conducting outreach and education within their communities to really help provide the kind of counter the misinformation that is out there about vaccines, but also to do it in a culturally and linguistic specific way and responsive way so that everyone who wants to get vaccinated can get vaccinated.
So like I mentioned, you know, we've been sprinkling in questions that we collected from our readers before this event, but we just got one from somebody who's watching live. Nick Miriam of Sea City is wondering about hybrid work policies, like the one that Microsoft is exploring. He asks, you know, these hybrid policies are certainly going to change the flow of people into the downtown corridor and business districts. And Nick wants to know how we can leverage that long-term change as an opportunity for keeping these areas vibrant.
Well, I'm sure Governor Gregoire has a lot to say to this. I have to say, trying to get into downtown Seattle, I just live a mile and a half away, still is really hard on I-5. So I'm not sure where everyone's going, but there's clearly lots of traffic getting into Seattle.
That's an intractable problem.
So I think coming out of COVID, we really have to think about our public transportation. We were growing dramatically in the use of public transportation. We were leading the nation. the last thing we need, to Chris's point, the last thing we need is everybody now saying, well, I'm just going to drive my car downtown, because we're never going to get there and get out of it, if that's the attitude we're all going to have. So we've been trying to work with public transportation to forecast what they can expect. And it's really challenging to figure out what are the population going to do. But we really need to encourage the population to feel good about getting back into public transportation, that it's been taking all the right measures, all the right steps to make sure it's safe and secure for them. One of the things I worry about a lot as we come out of COVID is, yes, we can have a hybrid model. We don't have to come downtown 5 days a week. We can, you know, come down one day a week or whatever. That opens up all kinds of options for people, by the way, to move to places if they choose, that are more affordable to them, and be able to come down once a week. But again, even at that, public transportation is the key to our success for tomorrow. So how do we invite people to get back, in this instance, interestingly enough, to where they were pre-COVID, where they were really gravitating towards public transportation, and understand that if we want to tackle climate change, if we want to get homes to our families in a timely way, it's in our hands. We can do it. And driving your own car downtown isn't the avenue we want them to take.
I agree with both what Chris and the governor said. And we were having a conversation with some colleagues. And I said, you know, my definition, Gordon's definition of downtown in quotes is South Lake Union to the north, SoTo to the south, the waterfront, obviously, to the west, and Broadway to the east. But when I think about going downtown, my offices are, you know, 720 Second Street. But why am I going downtown? I want to go to the Pikes, you know, I want to go to the market. I want to go walk up on Broadway. I want to cruise through my alma mater, Seattle U. I want to go down on the waterfront. I want to go to, Gasworks Park. I mean, getting people out of their homes and out of east, north, south into this corridor that I just described, there are a lot of reasons to do that. And they're not all tied to the fact your office building is there. So we do need to have a vibrant, attractive, multi-reasoned, to come into that area. And Chris is right. And if it's I-5 and single occupancy vehicles, well, it's going to grind to, it's never going to get started. So I think we can, and then I think that's what I just described, the International District, Chinatown, the waterfront, the aquarium, those are all reasons to come downtown to experience above and beyond work. And so I think we can get back there. We just have to make it attractive. And I think it needs to be reliable public transportation. And our staff says it needs to be clean, so people are worried, if they're not talking about it to you, they're worried not just about having to encounter somebody who's having a tough time, but they want to make sure they're not going to get sick because they're riding public transportation, because they're in a common vehicle as opposed to their own vehicle. So I think we do have to, again, to Chris's point, we have to reimagine what is the expectation of the community, broadly defined, after a year of COVID. Let's understand it, and let's find the willpower to make it happen. And when we do, we'll get that hot economy. We'll get that back, the reasons why people navigate and come to the Northwest if they aren't born here. There's something special here, and we just need to leverage our strengths and make sure that they're available to everybody.
And I think to that, both what Gordon and Governor Gregoire shared, it continues to reinforce that kind of the vibrancy of this commercial cultural corridor is interdependent on transportation, climate change, and economic recovery. And that's really, from a policy perspective, what we saw laid bare this past year was the way we have built our policy system is a set of patchworks that we have applied over generations. And again, when we're thinking about recovery that needs to be reimagined and reinvented, it is a unique opportunity to say, how do we look at all of these things together? And how do we ensure that the policies and systems we are rebuilding and reinventing actually keep that in mind, that all of us in a community of ecosystems, but individual workers and families, have to navigate each one of these systems? And how do we make sure that it's done in a way that is in complement and coordination with one another rather than working at odds?
I think that it's clear that these changes that we're talking about are, they present opportunities. I think the biggest question is opportunities for who? And you could certainly say it's an opportunity for companies that don't really want all of their employees to return to the office 5 days a week. I think Zillow is a good example of that. Many people in Seattle would say it's an opportunity for Bellevue, which is seeing a lot of growth in its commercial district. But ultimately, do we have to accept that in order to grow in this way, the character of our downtown Seattle urban core is going to change? And is that change necessarily for the better or for the worse?
Well, I would say it was changing anyway. We need to think about the potential of that waterfront. It's now open to the city when before it was closed off. And that new aquarium is going to be fantastic. So look at the opportunity we've got there, the addition on the convention center and what it can mean for us going forward. Go out to SeaTac and look at what they've got going out there. There are so many things that have been going on now for some time to make the community more vibrant that I think we have every reason to be optimistic. Now the question is, will we make sure that everybody feels good about coming downtown, that it gets its spirit back, that the restaurants are open, that people are back to work, that there's a sense of welcome? One of the things while we've been working on racial equity is very disturbing to me, and that is what our polling shows is that our BIPOC community doesn't feel welcome in downtown, as you described it, Gordon. They don't feel welcome. Well, that has to change. That's not good for us, as Chris puts it, all of us. We have to have the welcome mat out. We can't afford a Seattle freeze. So we have to be an inclusive, open, welcoming community at large, and then see the potential of what we've got. Now, some of our private sector is thriving. Too much of it is not. It is just not. Our small businesses, our women-owned, our minority-owned businesses are not thriving. And they're kind of the culture, the spirit, the heart of a community. To go into that small business and feel how that is. So we've got to get everybody back to a job if they choose and can. We have got to get our kids back in school. We have got to get our businesses up and running again for everyone. If we do that and take advantage to the kinds of things that are going on, get our arts and music back up and running, again, we can return to what is being rated as one of the best regions in the country. And that's what we deservedly have before us. But it's up to us to take advantage of it.
I'm glad that you steered us to this kind of optimistic place, because I think that in spite of all the challenges that we've been discussing that are very real, this moment does feel optimistic. So I'm curious if one or more of you could share with me what gives you the most hope for our region in 2021 as we look ahead.
Well, I think, all of us, Gordon, Governor Gregoire, myself, really emphasize that. Jane did in her opening. And that is, we came together differently as a community this past year. And that was informal partnerships, as noted, and cross-sector partnerships with the private, the public, and philanthropic sectors, really showcasing and putting the spotlight on communities most impacted and the innovative and creative ways that BIPOC leaders and organizations and mutual aid associations all came together. And that is an example of, I think, the best of a sense of collective and collective action that we will need going forward. And we haven't, touched on the ways that part of, I think, what got illuminated this past year, and especially if you look at the violence and the attacks on the U.S. Capitol in early January, what also has been a threat through the past year is just the continued weakening of some of our democratic ideals and institutions. And so we've had like extreme individualism and kind of hyper-localism, and some may argue very excessive capitalism that has pulled us apart. And the fabric, the underlying social fabric, has been fraying. And I think what we saw is that people came together differently, and that principle and that set like sense of a common good was critical for us getting to the place we are. And it is going to be even more important moving forward if we are really going to reimagine through reinvention, and specifically looking to address all of the shifts we need to make using centering racial equity, knowing that these disparities fundamentally compromise our region in terms of shared prosperity and belonging and sustained and sustainable growth.
Well stated. I would echo that. For me, it is that collaboration, the coordinating, and doing so intentionally around those who are most vulnerable, and the recognition that is our BIPOC community. It's also, of course, elders and immigrant and refugees, but we're more aware and we recognize that the intentionality is so important. And as I said earlier, the aha moment that there are some things we've taken to granted that we now call essential services. And those of us who have, some standing, some wealth, it's not as critical, but the idea that our libraries, community spaces, parks, not just educators, but nonprofit providers, centers that take care of our elderly. When we think about what we've gone through and how we now understand what is most important, it is a great springboard, if we do it in an inclusive manner, to really strengthen our region. And let's do it locally. I'm a regionalist, but we can start with King County and Snohomish County and Kitsap County and do some really good things and continue to demonstrate to the rest of this country or the world that when good people come together, eyes wide open and inclusive, we can do some remarkable things. And I'm confident we can do that. And it shouldn't take a once in 100-year crisis to get us to that stage. It has. So the crisis is not over with, and the hard work is just beginning.
My colleagues have said it and said it well. Thank you, Gordon. Thank you, Chris. The only thing I would say is we've learned and we've listened over the course of the last year. By listening to the BIPOC community, by listening to the homeless, I can't tell you how much I've learned. And it has influenced everything I do now when I work on these public policy issues. And it has the same with the business community. That's good. But we shouldn't stop that. We need to continue to listen, learn, respect other viewpoints, and come together as a community like we have over the course of the last year. I think we've shown we can lead the nation. We did lead the nation. And we can do it again on all of the issues that we're concerned about if we all work together. And so I'm really quite optimistic about the future and what COVID has taught us about working together, about listening and learning, because I think that's what will achieve success for all in this region and across our state.
Well, on that hopeful note, I'd like to extend a big thanks to Governor Gregoire, Gordon, and Chris for this thoughtful discussion. And thanks again to Microsoft for their support of our Civic Conversation series. If you missed any components of today's discussion or you just want to follow up on any key points, we'll be sharing the video with all registered participants. And don't forget, the GeekWire Awards are coming up on May 20th. So you can register and nominate your favorite tech entrepreneurs and innovators at geekwire.com/awards. Thanks everyone for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to GeekWire and for tuning in to our new Civic Conversation series. We'll have more virtual events coming up, so just check out geekwire.com/events to learn more. Thanks again to Microsoft, which is the underwriting sponsor of GeekWire's Civic coverage. To see all of GeekWire's coverage of science, tech, business, and more, go to geekwire.com and sign up for our daily email newsletter to receive all of our stories. Our podcast producer is Kurt Milton. Our theme music is by Daniel L.K. Caldwell. I'm GeekWire co-founder John Cook. We'll see you next week on the GeekWire podcast.